listening to CPR, communitypublicradio.org. And this is Weekday World. I'm your host, Don DeBar. With a report of some of the news and events of the past 24 hours from the CPR Newsroom. From Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar. 15 years of forever wars, religious divisions which threatened to further inflame the civil war in Ukraine, a retrospective on former UN Secretary General Kofi Annan, and the Trump media log rolling. Those are some of the headlines on this week's ConsortiumNews.com, and we spoke with Executive Editor Joe Loria via Skype from Washington, D.C., late Tuesday. Let's start with the banner, 15 Years of Forever Wars.
Yeah, that's a piece that I put up last night. It's actually a speech given back in May by Chas Friedman, former ambassador Chas Friedman, who was one of our most lucid voices in Washington about American foreign policy. Mm. And basically, he looks back, and I hadn't realized this, that on May 1st, 2003, there were two speeches made that day, one in Kabul by Don Rumsfeld, the then Secretary of Defense, who said that Afghanistan had now been stabilized, and basically the war was over. Right. And we had Bush on that very same day landing on the USS Abraham in this unbelievable PR stunt where he supposedly flew the plane in and got out and took his flight suit off and announced that mission was accomplished.
Right.
War in Iraq's over. So on the same day, May 1, 2003, Rumsfeld and Bush said these two wars are over. And the Afghan war started in 2001,
right.
October, I believe,
yep.
or November. And now it's 2018, so we're going on to 17 years, the longest war, blah, 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 in American history. And the Iraq War, which, okay, there's a much smaller number of U.S. troops there, but it is not a completely stabilized country by any means. I had lived there for 2 years, just up until last year.
Right.
So these wars are going on. And I think clearly that not only were they lying back then, saying that everything was stabilized or seriously mistaken, take your choice.
Right.
That I think the intentions of the neoconservatives are to keep these wars going. They're not intended to be won. They're intended, in my opinion, and I'm only making this a judgment based on what I've seen over these 17 years, is that the purpose of these wars is to keep countries that can cause trouble to the U.S. in terms of its geostrategy in the Middle East or elsewhere, to keep these countries divided and killing one another, and then they're no longer any danger to Israel or to the U.S. interests in the region.
Right.
And there's a whole lot of hell of a contract money to be made, as we saw in Iraq
right.
and Afghanistan and anywhere else. So the money keeps flowing in, and the countries remain at odds with each other, killing one another, destabilized, terrorism continues, and the U.S. is saying we're still fighting for freedom and against terrorism, when, of course, they backed what became the Islamic State in Syria and Iraq, and Russia went in to stop those to stop ISIS in Syria and al-Qaeda, and they're the ones who are the problem, as we heard from Jeremy Hunt today in his speech in Washington, the Foreign Secretary of Britain, that Russia's up to no good in the world and we got to stop them. And, you know, everyone believes this. And if they care about Russia at all, Don, as we saw,
right.
I'm talking about the American people, not the rulers, the bipartisan establishment in the U.S. and in Britain. Certainly, they believe Russia is a big, big threat. Not Corbyn, but certainly the Tories and both parties in the U.S. Russia is a threat, not just in our elections, but also their invasions of Georgia, even though the European Union said that Georgia started that. And then in Syria, even though it's very clear that why Russia went in there, and we now know that that's the case, and John Kerry admitted it in this leaked tape when he spoke to Syrian exiles in New York. And at the end of 2015, he said that he saw the reason Putin went in was to stop ISIS from taking over Syria. This is mm-hmm. more or less a direct quote from Kerry.
Right.
So the Americans knew why Russia did what they did in Syria, but they lied. And the press, which in my opinion is more guilty than the government. We expect government people to lie. They're supposed to lie. They lie. The press is supposed to be there to stop them
right.
from lying, to challenge them,
right.
to protect the American people or other publics from those lies, and they're going right along with that.
I mean, it's worse
than
that.
This is what's so troubling.
So it's worse than that, because the mechanism of the government lying to us isn't some guy from Congress showing up at your front door and lying to you through the screen. They speak in front of a bunch of reporters who are able to ask questions and who don't. And even if you're sitting in front of your television watching one of these press conferences, for example, or looking at the sites from press releases that they received and, you know, over via email or whatever, questions that would occur to you or to a child are not asked at all. And instead, they run interference for them. And it happens so blatantly in front of us, and it's happened so, like, wall to wall through the media. And yet people, you know, they wonder why when they poll us, nobody trusts the media.
Well,
this is one
right.
of the effects.
The media is supposed to be, that's right. The entire American public can't get into a press conference to ask their questions. They're relying on the press to ask the questions for them.
Right.
The media is supposed to be the representative of the people in keeping government and to account. And I disagree with Trump's reasons for saying it. He has different reasons, but I agree that the press, therefore, is the enemy of the American public
right.
simply because they're not the defender of the American public.
Right.
They, by default, become the enemy. And he's saying that because they're attacking him personally. I mean, who gives a damn? I'm talking about much larger issues that go back way before Trump and will continue after Trump. The media is not representing public's interests, and that is a huge, huge problem. I'll give you an example today. New York Times, David Sanger, Shira Frankel. The Russian military intelligence unit that sought to influence the 2016 election appears to have a new target, these conservative think tanks. Now,
right.
the military intelligence unit that sought to influence, so the New York Times has tried and convicted these Russian defendants in the pages of the New York Times. Why do we need courts, Don, when we have newspapers? get rid of the justice system.
Right.
We have the newspapers to convict people.
Right.
This is outrageous. This is really, they've lost their, it's the basic 101 principles of journalism, Journalism 101, that someone's accused of a crime, they're not guilty until proven in the court, and they're innocent until proven guilty. That's dispensed with in foreign affairs in general, and in particular on the Russia story.
Let's go back for a second. The statement that Rumsfeld made, we remember Bush standing in front of that huge banner,
right.
mission accomplished, okay, in his flight,
yep.
in his flight jacket. But Rumsfeld said, this is the quote that's in the article, we clearly, okay, we clearly have moved from major combat activity to a period of stability and stabilization and reconstruction, closed quote.
Reconstruction, yeah.
You know, now, that was May 1st, 2003. Was it the day before yesterday there was a rocket attack on the senior government officials in Kabul and the U.S. Embassy?
So it's a lie. It turns out to have been false. He was wrong, Rumsfeld. I don't remember ever hearing him apologize for that or at least correcting his mistake. You know, Afghanistan has huge resources that I think the U.S. is interested in, minerals, etc. It's a strategic location to Central Asia in terms of oil.
Right.
So the U.S. needs to, but they're losing that war. They have lost, basically.
People have been writing for 100 years about this. I mean, if you look at Orwell's 1984, even, that the whole basis of their economy was, you know, to be at constant war, permanent war with each other so that they could consume the resources, keep people whipped up in a patriotic fervor, and have an endless supply of money, basically being focused
on
things that you blow up, which takes care of the supply problem with the capitalist economy. And that's exactly what's happened. We've had massive military budgets after being promised a peace dividend, and nothing to show for it other than an awful lot of really miserable and dead people.
Absolutely. Go back to 1946 and 47. The Truman administration was terrified because the economy started to tank again when the war ended. That they came out of a depression with the war. It seemed like it was going back into one. He made a big deal with the aircraft manufacturers to build more planes. He instituted a draft, a first peacetime draft. He created the Cold War. They created tensions with the Soviet Union after the war and built a Cold War out of it with Churchill's help and a bunch of other people to want to build up a defense industry that is still the core of so many of our states and so many jobs around the United States. In each of the 50 states, as your listeners well know, there are these defense contracts in every state. So every senator is going to vote for this money that comes to the Defense Department. So that's why the U.S. continues. These leaders keep talking about fighting World War II over and over again. Everybody they want to take out is Hitler, Noriega,
right.
Saddam,
right.
Milosevic. I'm now Putin, as Clinton called him. They're all Hitler, and we're the good guys. And, of course, Americans don't know that it was Russia that won, the Soviet Union that won that war against the Nazis, not the U.S. and Britain.
Right.
They suffered the vast majority of it. But, you know, we take the credit for that. So we're still on the right side of history and spreading democracy. And if you look at that article in the New York Times that I mentioned before, which is so bizarre, not only do they dispense with the word alleged by blaming these Russians and convicting them in the pages of the newspaper, but they go further by then later in the article saying that this Republican Institute, I'm trying to find it here, that this Republican Institute is spreading democracy around. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah, the International Republic Institute, one of the ones that was supposedly hacked by the Russians.
Promoting democracy around the world. Right.
Yeah, has worked for decades in promoting democracy around the world. This was a flat statement in this morning's New York Times.
Yep. It's a statement of fact.
And it is a false lie.
Right. That's right. That's right. And so
that's a core myth, core part of the American myth, repeated all the time and this morning in the New York Times as well.
Yeah, well, here's you got among the board of directors, you've got McCain, Romney, and McMaster.
Yeah. Yep. There you go.
You know,
they're spreading democracy.
Yeah, and one of the places that they helped spread it was Kiev, by the way, to Ukraine.
That's correct.
They were heavily involved there. They've been heavily involved in spreading democracy in Latin America. They've been trying to spread democracy to Venezuela
Haiti.
For quite some time.
Yeah,
in Haiti, they've brought a lot of democracy. Not much food, though, but a lot of democracy. The people there get to eat democracy. So, I mean, we see one major problem here, of course. What else is going on in the landscape?
So let's look back at the front page here. We've got...
yes, indeed.
We have another story. I would like to talk about the piece that I rewrote, that I wrote in the Boston Globe in 2006.
Oh, about Kofi Annan. Yeah, definitely.
Let's do that. On Saturday, Kofi Annan died at the age of 80. Quite suddenly, he seemed to be in good health. Nobody knew about this. Personally, he was the most engaging Secretary General that I ever covered. I covered four of them.
Yeah, you knew him.
So
right?
I knew. I knew him quite well. Yeah, I'll give you a little small story. I was in Stockholm at a genocide conference, and there I met Samantha Power, by the way, when she was still a journalist. I had a conversation with her, and Kofi Annan attended this conference, and he did a press conference, and I was standing all the way in the back, and I didn't get a chance to ask a question or anything. And about a week later, I'm standing in UN headquarters in Jakarta, and Kofi Annan walks by, and he pulls away from his security people, comes up to me to shake my hand and say, "I saw you in Stockholm." Now, this guy is like Bill Clinton. He had that touch, right?
Uh-huh.
He knew how to butter up the press.
Yeah, yeah.
And everybody could say, well, he saw me. I didn't know that he even saw me, but he made it. So, yes, I knew the guy. I knew him when he was head of peacekeeping. But on my piece I wrote, which I don't think anybody's taken this angle, and I'm shocked when I read it now that it was in a mainstream newspaper, because my first paragraph ends with the phrase U.S. dominance, that I'm saying that Kofi Annan, the first Sub-Saharan African Secretary General, ends his 10-year term this Sunday. This is back to 2006, leaving behind a complex legacy during an era of genocide, terrorism, and U.S. dominance.
Yeah.
And what I'm saying was that he was pulled in two directions. His whole 10-year tenure was conflicted between doing what the U.S. wanted, because they put him in office. If you recall, Boutros-Ghali, who in my opinion was the most independent after Dag Hammarskjöld, the most independent Secretary General,
right,
because Boutros did not go along with the U.S., and they got it. They kicked him out. They vetoed.
Right,
his re-election. They had to veto it. They were trying.
He's the most independent one that didn't die in a mysterious plane crash, right?
Exactly. He did die a couple of years ago, but it wasn't a mysterious plane crash.
Like Hammarskjöld. Yeah.
Like Hammarskjöld. Yes. So Kofi was torn between, and my article explains how he did things, because he felt indebted. He had to help Africa. He was the first sub-Saharan African Secretary General, and he had to do something to help Africa and other developing countries, but he also owed the U.S., so he was constantly, and the big crisis for the Americans was when the BBC, a BBC interviewer, continuously badgered him to answer the question whether the invasion of Iraq in 2003 by the U.S. was illegal or not, and he had to admit it was illegal, because it did not have a Security Council authorization, and it was not in self-defense. And those are the only two rules on the UN charter, on international law, that a nation go to war if you're attacked, or if you get the council to agree that you need to go to war. Otherwise, it's illegal. Even if the Congress declared war, it's still, in terms of international law, it's illegal. And that's also U.S. law. The UN charter is part of U.S. law. All international law, when ratified by the Senate, becomes U.S. law as well. So my article goes through that. Now, some comments that your listeners can see if they go to the article are saying Kofi was just, you know, the UN stooge and all that. Well, I did another article about Ban Ki-moon for Consortium News when he left in 2017. Well, he left at the end of 2016 on New Year's Day 2017, and he was a complete stooge of the United States. And you can go and read that article in the archives.
Yeah.
Ban Ki-moon is the example of the absolute worst Secretary General, in my opinion.
Right.
I knew him too, and personally, I had no problems with him. I don't think he was corrupt. I think he had good intentions, but he was a complete man of the United States, complete yes man.
Yep.
And there were so many examples of that, particularly on issues with Russia, that he'd always took the U.S. side. So he's from South Korea, obviously, kind of a colony of the United States.
Yeah.
So it's not to be a surprise. He didn't have the same kind of pressures of a constituency that were demanding he stand up to the U.S. like an African, like a sub-Saharan African did. So that Kofi Annan, I think it's worth looking back on him and what's happened to the U.S. But again, I'm surprised that the Boston Globe even ran that, and I wonder if they would today, where I talk about U.S. dominance.
I know, it's amazing. It's really an amazing piece, actually. And just the way it's laid out, because it isn't just a turn of phrase there. I mean, you detail what you mean by it, and not in a flattering way. It's not a slanderous way either. It just details factually this U.S. dominance.
Yes,
that was the parameters of operating the United Nations. Yeah,
that's right. So, what else do we have on the front page? We've got a piece from Dmitry Babbage, the first article that he ever published on Consortium News, which is a complex piece, took a lot of editing. It was an article we had a long time before we published it, but it's interesting because it gives a different angle to the Ukraine crisis, the Ukraine civil war.
Yeah,
that isn't often looked at, but it may not be important so important to Americans or people who aren't Orthodox Christians or Christians at all, but it has a deep political significance. I mean, you have to understand how important religion is to people in Russia, in post-Soviet Russia, and in Ukraine.
Right.
And in fact, there are a lot of Roman Catholics in the western part of Ukraine who look to the west, but there's also a Ukrainian Orthodox Church that still has the name Moscow in its title, Moscow Patriarch.
Yeah, well, also
and
Kiev.
There was this,
Kiev was the first Russian city.
Well, that's right.
You know,
well,
going back. So
important.
The foundation of the church really, you know, comes through Kiev.
Absolutely, it was 1,030 years ago.
Yeah.
In fact, they just celebrated that anniversary on July 30th. That's what gave rise to this peace.
That's right.
That the Ukrainian authorities tried to stop Russians from coming, tried to stop people who don't agree with this breakaway church. And that's what the story is about, that there was a church, a breakaway church established in 1992 by this guy who lost an ecclesiastical election. And then it was right at the Soviet Union's collapse, he decided to create this separate Ukrainian Orthodox Church, apart from this one that has the title Moscow. And even though it's not ruled by Russia, it has its own organization. The Orthodox Church, as the article explains, is not like the Catholic Church, where it has centralized authority in Rome.
Right.
This is decentralized. In many ways, like Islam is decentralized. There's no pope.
Right.
There's no real head of the church. But this guy created this separate church, and you know, it's never been recognized by other Orthodox churches around the world. But now it was always left there to exist, but now it's taking on a huge role because Poroshenko, the president of Ukraine, is in league with this guy who started this separate church to try to take over the existing Orthodox church in Ukraine that has the name Moscow in it, that owns millions and maybe billions of dollars worth of property, that they want to take over this property and then make this the only church in Ukraine. So it's a fascinating story and leading to more and more tensions in what's already a very fraught situation in Ukraine, obviously.
Right. That the last thing that they need in Kiev is to have a break among the population over religion, when just about every other identity item is already used to keep the people divided there. Language was the first thing that they attacked.
That's right.
You know, as soon as the Maidan group seized power in a coup, the first act of the Rada, the parliament there, was to decertify Russian as one of the official languages, even though more than half the people in the country, in the eastern part of the country, most of the people speak Russian as a first language.
Well, that's right. And Dmitry corrected me because I had thought, because when they did that, there was an outcry, particularly from European governments. So they reversed that decision and reinstated Russian language as. But now Dmitry's point out, I did not know, it just slipped through the cracks, that they sometime later, with American backing, they have decertified Russian language again.
Yep, that's right. Yep. Yeah, they moved it down the agenda a couple items, that's all.
That shouldn't have been the first thing they did, like when the Clintons came in and did the gay policy in the midterms. The first thing they did, you remember that?
That's right.
There was an outcry. So this is what the first thing they did. Well, they showed their hand, how anti-Russian they are, and what that was all about, was an anti-Russian coup and an anti-Russian government, et cetera. And we could talk about Ukraine a long time. But this is one aspect that has not gotten any attention. And that's Consortium News's one of its main purposes, is to publish stories that the mainstream media in the United States and in the West ignore, and from a different angle, obviously. Even if we publish stories they do publish, we have a completely different angle on it.
So I think we could close with, while we're waiting Tuesday afternoon to find out what's happening with Cohen, with Trump's attorney, who's going to be pleading out, apparently we're told he's going to be pleading out his case in court late this afternoon. We could talk about, Sam Husseini's pieces on the front page about that, spectacle last Thursday, where all these corporate newspapers did a coordinated editorial. That was kind of scary. I hadn't seen anything like that since September 11, 2001, when they all had kind of the same, everything was on the same one channel, or one program was on all channels. This was kind of like that with the editorial pages.
Well, exactly. So Sam took what is obviously an unpopular position in the mainstream, but very popular with our readers, and saying, well, yes, Trump's been horrible, and he deserves a lot of the criticism he's gotten in the media, and his attacks are childish. But let's not forget that the mainstream media has to do a lot of soul searching itself, and that in these editorials, there was no mention of Julian Assange and the possible prosecution of WikiLeaks and Assange. And that is a key, obviously, I think, the most important issue about freedom of the press right now. Because even the New York Times number two lawyer told a group of judges out in California a couple of weeks ago, and Ray McGovern wrote a piece about it for us, that he told them that prosecuting Julian Assange and WikiLeaks is very problematic for the New York Times. Because the Times not only published WikiLeaks leaks back during the Bush administration, when for the Democrats that was great because Assange was exposing Bush and his crimes. But as soon as he exposed Hillary Clinton, then we got to get this guy. But right. This lawyer, speaking only from a legal point of view, not political, not editorial, saying, listen, we've done the same thing. We also publish classified material all the time. We will in the future. If the United States prosecutes a publisher for doing that, not for stealing the documents, actually, but for just receiving them and publishing them, well, how is that different from what we do? The only difference is he gives the raw material, where we write an article and give our spin.
Right.
So in the old days, the New York Times would actually print a lot more full documents in the papers.
Yeah,
for example, the Pentagon Papers,
right.
If I recall,
right.
Whole sections of it were printed over pages inside right. The New York Times.
Right.
So it wasn't just the article. They actually gave huge sections of the text. They would always publish the text of a major speech. I don't know if you recall back then, Don.
I do, for sure.
The New York Times.
Yeah.
Kind of reams of pages on news, and they would also have whole speeches and things and documents republished, because now they can provide a link online.
Right.
But the point is, WikiLeaks does the same thing the New York Times does, and that's why this is so serious, and why if the editorials were all going to be coordinated like that against Trump, they had to mention other issues. And they never look at themselves, the press. They are, you know, they think they're the defenders of democracy, which we earlier in this conversation laid out that I believe they aren't. And they're the defenders of the establishment. And this is another case. This is an establishment, 300 establishment newspapers supporting an establishment position. And without going anywhere near WikiLeaks, without talking about why Heather Nauert doesn't ask any questions of Russian, answer any Russian reporters' questions anymore, or the
right.
registration of RT. Now they want Al Jazeera to be registered. All these other issues that the press is involved in is never mentioned in these editorials. So it was just an anti-Trump thing.
Right.
He deserves a lot of criticism, but, you know, so does the press. That's what Sam was saying.
Yeah. He ran through a list of a number of things that this press has no problem with whatsoever. RT and Sputnik, by the way, Al Jazeera and a bunch of others having to register as foreign agents, like you mentioned, and Heather Nauert, not just refusing to take questions from Russian reporters, mocking them on a couple of occasions, as did Jen Psaki and Harf and a whole, you know, a whole bunch of them. Some folks that shouldn't be making fun of anybody were doing it, that were at the State Department.
Yeah.
Okay, we can go back to the last administration for that. And also the things that have been happening with social media, particularly egregious in my opinion, is Telesur being banned from Facebook. Telesur is, you know, the most, I would say, the one independent transnational news outlet in the Western Hemisphere, and you know, it's the Central and South American independent press, in essence, and Caribbean independent.
That's
press.
That's why it needed to be banned.
And they're
that's
banned
why
from
it needed
Facebook.
To be banned.
Yep.
And you would think it's independent.
That's right. That's exactly the
from
the
Western
point.
American point of view. It may not say everything. I mean, they may have errors in their reporting and whatnot, but the people need to have a vast array of voices and points of view. And that's all we're asking for here, and not just the establishment Western media point of view, but that's what they're whittling away attempts. They want only the people to listen to what the establishment says, because that reinforces the fact that it's Russia's fault that we have racial divisions in the United States and a growing economic divide, and that they're undermining our democratic institutions, not plutocrats buying the American political system, or long history of racial division, or these 30 years of economic neoliberal economic policies that are destroying people's lives here and the middle class. No, it's the Russians who are doing it. So they need the media, the central established media, to be pressing that message that the Russian agents are the ones who did it without any kind of a trial. The Times convicts them. That's why they've got to get rid of. Now, they still have their websites, but they could work on that. So little by little, they realize that social media has become the vehicle to present news from websites. Yes, you can still go to the Taylor Swift website, as far as I know, this morning, I think. And yeah, you can still go to Alex Jones, if that's your cup of tea. It isn't mine, obviously, to go there, but he should have. That's the whole point about censorship. You got to defend the person you dislike the most. Just like the ACLU defended those neo-Nazis in Illinois outside Chicago 30, 40, 50 years, whatever that was, when they marched.
Yep.
You have to defend, and ACLU today actually came out in defense of Alex Jones. Not Alex Jones, what he's saying, but his right to say it. And this is an unbelievably perilous development, and it's slippery, and we did our second Consortium News, our first Consortium News radio interview with Peter Van Buren, a former State Department official and whistleblower on Iraq, who got into a Twitter war with mainstream reporters over whether or not they support America's war efforts. And only a moron would not see that they don't. Just look at the 2003 invasion of Iraq and the lead up to that.
Right.
But he made the fatal error. So you got to be very, very careful online, because if you say the slightest thing that gives them a chance to get you on their so-called community standards, they
That's
will.
Right. Snip
he ended
out.
One
That's
very right. rational argument with some reporter, some mainstream reporter, by saying, I hope somebody, a guy wearing a MAGA hat, eats your face.
Right. And that was
when
enough.
He crossed that
was
line.
Enough. That's right. That was it.
You got to be really careful. Same as Caitlin Johnstone.
Yep.
She went over the line by saying she thought the world would be an improved place when John McCain dies. That's not even, you know. So that was enough for Twitter to suspend her.
That's right.
But only for a day. Van Buren has been deleted. His whole 7 years of tweets have been deleted, and he's permanently banned from Twitter.
And meanwhile, the assembled corporate press were able to lie, in essence, for a year, 2, 3 years, and create a war in Iraq where none should have, and a million or better people died, and nothing. All right, we got to get out of here. We're out of time. Joe, thank you. We'll speak with you again next week. Keep on keeping on.
Thank you, Don. All the best.
And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.
Hello and welcome to Crosstalk, where all things are considered. I'm Peter Lavelle. Remember when the political left stood up for free speech and equality for all in public life? Remember when the mainstream media called for the same? The tone and tenor of political discourse appears to be at a turning point. If you don't agree with the left, you face insults, harassment, and even violence. Is a new civil war on? Crosstalking political civility, I'm joined by my guest, Rob Taub in New York. He is a political pundit and journalist contributing to the Huffington Post. In West Palm Beach, we have Dr. Gina Loudon. She is a psychology expert and host of America Trends with Dr. Gina. And in Los Angeles, we cross to Ron Placone. He is a comedian, frequent guest on The Jimmy Dore Show and The Young Turks, as well as host of his own streaming show, Get Your News On with Ron. All right, crosstalk rules in effect. That means you can jump in anytime you want, and I always appreciate it. Gina, let me go to you, because I know your political stripes pretty well, and reflect upon what I had to say in the introduction. I mean, if you don't agree, you face insults, harassment, and violence. Ask Representative Scalise about what it means to be on the receiving end of violence. It seems to me, and I don't want to over-dramatize things, but over the last few weeks, it seems to me that part of the political spectrum wants to normalize political violence, in terms of speech, at least. Go ahead, Gina, in West Palm Beach.
Yeah, it's discouraging because I think that my whole political life, my thing has been that sometimes I'm wrong and I hold myself out to the fact that I may be wrong, but I enjoy the civil discourse. Some of my favorite things to do have always been shows like yours where you can have a conversation in a civil dialogue without ridiculing the other person, without calling them names, without accusing them of some form of bigotry. But the left has taken attack. You called it a civil war. I'm calling it an uncivil war, a massive step away from civility. And then they tend to want to do this blame game and blame the whole thing on the fact that the president is somebody who hits back just because conservatives traditionally have never hit back. And so I think that it puts conservatives like me in a really discouraging place in that we've always wanted somebody who would hit back the bully on the playground, right? I think that's a good thing because bullies in politics, they shut down civil discourse. But in this particular case, I think the left has taken it far too far, Steve Scalise being case one, but there are a lot of other cases that we're seeing almost every day now in the political environment.
You know, Rob, I used to remember is that, okay, I can understand, you know, the liberals used to be the ones that were tolerant and wanted dialogue and wanted to engage people. And now we have a president which who can be quite vulgar at times. I think everybody on the panel and our viewers would agree. Many times he's a bit rough, okay? But why does the left now have to emulate that? I mean, aren't they supposed to be better? They've always presented themselves as being the better part of the political spectrum. It seems to me they want to get in the mud and fight it out that way, which is not really part of the left's tradition, at least my reading of it. Go ahead, Rob.
Well, there's an old expression that you don't get into a peeing match with a skunk. And I think it's been a huge error on the part of Democrats. But I'm going to make it clear, Donald Trump has set the stage for all of this. And if there were 60,000 people in Yankee Stadium and everybody cheered for him except one person, he'd be tweeting about that one person that doesn't like him. But I don't think that the Democrats are doing the right thing, my fellow Democrats, in the attacks that they make against Trump, against his allies, just in general. I think Maxine Waters is the biggest enemy to the Democratic Party. You just look like an idiot saying the things that she says and does, and I find it repugnant. I've been attacked because I'll speak and I'll say, well, as a Democrat, and then I get blasted on Twitter from people saying, you can't say that. You're not a real Democrat. You're a phony. You're a plant. You're a bot. And so it's like, oh, I can't have any kind of dissenting opinion. I have to just have an automatonic-like response, then it'll be okay.
I mean, Rob,
so that's what gets me angry.
With all due respect, what do you expect from identity politics, okay? That's exactly where it goes. You're not fitting the mold, you know? Then you're an enemy. That's what identity politics does. Let me go to Ron. Ron, what does the left hope to achieve by this strategy? I mean, you know, you don't have the leadership speaking out against it. Schumer said something and then he got attacked for it. Again, identity politics comes into play. It's a losing proposition. I don't know what the Democrats hope to achieve by going down this path. Go ahead, Ron.
Well, you know, I don't want to split hairs on optics here, but I think when you in the topic of this conversation, when you say the left, what you're really referring to is the Democratic establishment.
Fine. Good.
In the corporate media.
Good.
And I would argue, just for optics' sake, that's not the left. One could argue that something like an MSNBC and the Democratic establishment, that is, in fact, the liberal establishment. But when you say liberal, you should be using it in the Phil Oaks sense. 10% to the left in the best of times,
and Ron,
10% to the right,
Ron,
when it affects them
and
personally.
And to be fair, the question is,
that's actually what they are.
Ron,
there's nothing actually progressive about them.
I agree with that. Okay, but in the questions that I sent out to everyone here, I said establishment left. So your clarification. Okay, but what my question is, what does the establishment left want to achieve by taking on this strategy? All it does is increase, you know, it just increases the volume and the temperature of political discourse when we have none, to the point where we don't have any. Okay, go ahead, Ron.
Oh, I agree with you. And I think they really thrive on creating this A and B dichotomy of, hey, we're not Trump and Trump's awful and we're not that. When it comes time to talk to policy, they really don't have any ideas. You know, we live more than ever before. We live in a two-party system. Lewis Black said it best. The Republicans have bad ideas. The Democrats have no ideas. So when you have absolutely no ideas, and when you have this president that's kind of a knee-jerk reactionary, you know, that says, you know, some outrageous things sometimes, what else can you do but then get into the match yourself? Engage in the hyper-partisan clickbait culture that we're a part of and try to run with it and hope that maybe you beat a Republican or two in 2018. The third priority of the Democratic Party is winning. Their first priority, making sure progressive policies don't happen. Their second priority, which those two things kind of go hand in hand, is pleasing their donors. Their third priority, maybe beating a Republican or two. By engaging in just partisan bickering, you're getting all three of those things accomplished. Well, you're getting those top two things accomplished. Maybe that third one, too. Maybe.
That's a recipe for a disaster. Okay. Gina, reflect upon the fact that recently, over the last weeks or so, it's been conservative women, particularly, that have been attacked in public. We don't have to go through all the names because there's so many of them now. I mean, I thought the Democratic Party loved women and respected women. Go ahead, Gina.
Yeah, we had the whole when they go low, we'll go high thing. It looks like when someone goes low, they're going to go lower. The whole war on women thing, they've turned that into a war on any woman who disagrees with their politics. I would really like to get back to a time where we can have a conversation a little bit like we're having right now, frankly, where probably the three of us wouldn't agree on policy matters much at all, but we can definitely agree that civility and conversation are a much more intelligent way to go about establishing policy that works for America than slinging insults. And especially, as you pointed to, Peter, it's the identity politics, I would argue, not the president, the identity politics that have brought the Democrats to where they are in what has amounted to a truly uncivil war that is really among the left. The right, we're getting along pretty well, not perfectly, but pretty well. I remember a few years ago when I thought the Republican Party was imploding. But at this point, I really think that identity politics is imploding the left, that they have got to get some issues to stand on and to work together, frankly, because even if the three of us, four of us, sat down and discussed policy we could agree on, we could find something that all of us are passionate about and we could fight together on that. But rather than that, the American people, and especially the traditional Democrats out there, they're watching this lunacy go on the left and thinking, I don't know, but I know that's not what I want. And they'll lose in the midterms because of it, I feel quite sure, at least at this point, if something doesn't change fast.
You know, Rob, why can't the establishment Democrats rein these people in? Are they afraid they're worried that their base is drifting to more progressive socialists? We could look at what happened in New York. I mean, what's their lack of reaction? Because it seems like the lack of reaction shows the huge splits within the party. Go ahead, Rob.
It's a completely fragmented party right now. There's no leadership. Who can you say is the leader of the Democratic Party? No
Maxine,
one. Nancy Pelosi,
Maxine,
Bernie Sanders,
Maxine Waters,
Cory Booker, Maxine. So, you know, and here's my proclamation for the Democrats that they have to get. The sky is always blue, water is always wet, and Donald Trump is always going to be Donald Trump. So stop complaining about what he says and what he does, because he's always going to do that. Why don't you throw some policy at us and tell us what you're going to do, Democrats, to get rid of him? Or why should we vote him out? What is your plan? As a Democrat, I can't speak to any policy I've heard other than Donald Trump is a creep and a jerk. Okay, I agree. So what? What are we going to do?
Ron, you're agreeing there. No, that my point is that it's ever since the campaign, not even the election, is that the more you go after this guy, the mainstream media, the more you push him up. And it's free advertising. I've seen him go out on the road. I mean, all he does is attack these people and they love it, okay? They're giving him all his material, Ron.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. And I'm sorry, guys, I missed a little bit. I was having a tech issue on my end. I apologize for that. At first, I thought I was like, wow, was it something I said? I don't know. I thought we were having a good discussion. But everything just kind of went out for me for a second. So if I'm not totally caught up, I apologize. But, yeah, I think, Rob, you bring up a very good point. Really good, they don't have any policy ideas. I don't think that's an accident, though. And that's why, again, I'm very disenfranchised by the two-party system right now, because I don't feel that there's anybody with power in politics, with exception to Bernie Sanders, that represents any of the policies
I'm going to jump in here. I'm going to jump in here. We're going to go to a short break, and after that short break, we'll continue more discussion on political civility. Stay with RT.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Okay, let's go back to Ron in L.A. On Skype here. Right before we went to the break, you wanted to finish up a point. Please go ahead.
Yeah, I mean, I was just getting at, you know, Rob brings up that he's not seeing any policy ideas from the Democrats. He's absolutely right. I think this is by design. I think that really the United States is ready to go in a more populist direction. If the four of us, you know, the four of us sat down, as Dr. Gina was saying, if the four of us sat down and really talked policy, we wouldn't agree on everything. We seem to kind of be all over the spectrum. We have different points of views on different things. However, there would be some really big pillars that I think we would all have in common. I think we would all want to end the wars and invest that money back home. I think we would all want to see a populace where unemployment is in better shape. We might have some different ideas on how to get there, but it's something that we would all want to see happen. There would be some big, crucial, for instances, where we would be on the same page. Who does that not benefit? That doesn't benefit the establishment.
That's right, Ron. Let me go to Gina here. You know why all four of us can have a civil conversation? Because we don't have to worry about donors. Really, that's the reason why. Okay.
Yeah. You become
more of a fair
donors in re-election. That's right.
That's right. You know, Gina, one of the things that really bothers
None
me.
None of us are in the same room
it,
either.
Okay. One of the things that really bothers me about what's going on here is that my first incarnation professionally, I was an academic historian, and I taught courses at the University of California. And I really, really hate it when people start using the term Nazi and calling someone Hitler, because I know the history of the 20th century in Europe extremely well. And the people on the left throwing those terms around are so abjectly incorrect and without knowledge. They don't know what they're actually saying. It's a very terrible, those are terrible terms, and you have to use them very sparingly. Go ahead, Gina, because this is what gets on my nerves.
Well, and that is discouraging to me, too, for exactly the reasons that Ron cited, when I believe that there are productive things we could do if we would actually work together. And for all the criticism of this president, he has been someone who's willing to work with his political enemies. And he's willing to sit down with Democrats, and he's willing to ask their opinion. And that's one of the things I like best about him. He's even willing to call himself off once he's really decided somebody's a bad person, and to stop and listen. And if we had a little more of that particular element in our society, I think we'd be better. The Democrats have themselves in a real position, and here's why. Their money is coming from the far extreme left, those in Hollywood, and the progressives in general. But their votes come from places like the Rust Belt, the unions, where the jobs are drying up because of illegal immigration and other sorts of policies that the Democrats have passed. So the Democrats can't figure out how to get both the money and the votes. And that's their dilemma. They're going to have to start to develop, if they're going to survive in a two-party system, as Ron referred to, they're going to have to develop some sort of policy that can appeal to a broader base and pull from Republicans. Not that I'm here to advise the Democrats, although that sounds like that's just what I did. But I kind of watched some of these problems happen within the Republican Party not all that long ago. And I honestly, and you may not believe me because I am on the right and I don't deny that, but I've landed here honestly, and I'm willing to admit when I'm wrong. I honestly crave a government where we have a strong opponent that comes up with good ideas.
Yeah.
So that makes my side better. I think that polishes all of us when we're all more honest.
That's a very smart observation. And I think that's really good. And that makes the political debate, brings it up to a higher level here. Rob, I want to go back to this historical thing because I think it's really important here. I mean, when we have people, you know, it's like the Antifa people that, you know, this really, the fringe people, they're saying that, you know, making comparisons to Nazi Germany. Well, I would say that there is a historical analogy, and it's Weimar Germany, where Germany was collapsing in the 1920s for a whole wide variety of issues. But there was, during that time, there was the lack of respect and the breakdown of public discourse. That's one of the reasons why the Nazis were able to come to power. And I think that this is a critical moment, that's a history lesson, is if you continue down this path, yes, you could create a very, very disturbing future, but we are not there yet. And I think people need to step back. And all of us here are of a like mind. Policy, and more policy. I'm tired of the emotions. Go ahead, Rob.
Well, first of all, as a Jew, I don't like the word Nazi thrown around so arbitrarily and easily. I think Trump, I'll make it clear, I think he's despicable. I don't like him. He demonizes immigrants, but that's not the same thing as what took place in Nazi Germany. And I agree with you, Peter. We have to look at things historically. It's like what happened in Iran with the Ayatollah Khomeini. And we were so upset about that as Americans. Well, why did that happen? Who did we support? We supported the Shah of Iran. What, you know, Republicans used to complain so much vociferously when Fidel Castro took power, but we had multinational corporations in Cuba paying workers 2 cents a day there. So of course there was a revolution. So we have to look at what leads up to things. And things, Donald Trump didn't just pop out of nowhere and invent himself and just get elected by magic. There were things that upset and infuriated people, and he had voters that came in and elected him. And so we have to look at the why instead of, again, complaining about Donald Trump. Oh, he's this, he's that, he's terrible, he's a jerk. And Tom Landry had a great sign when he was coach of the Dallas Cowboys that said, "What if?" There is no what if. So let's deal with reality and what's happening right now. And again, I'm going back to policy.
You know, Ron, we had Supreme Court Justice Kennedy announces he's stepping down. I'm really worried. And I mean, if we think the political atmosphere is bad now, wait until his successor is announced and before he goes or she goes before Congress. I mean, this is going to be one hell of a storm ahead of us here because it's already started. I mean, the ink wasn't even dry in the document, and that war really started flaring out. I'm really worried about how this process is going to work. Go ahead, Ron.
Well, I mean, you know, I'm also worried about a hyper-conservative Supreme Court for years to
come. I understand that. But what I'm saying is that I'm more worried right now is the process, because what it does is it taints the entire process. It taints the court. And now you have people on the left, extreme left, doubting the Constitution itself. Now, there's a lot of things that need to be done. But if we don't have the same playing field and the same laws, then we're even further away from communication. There is going to be a confirmation process. And now the Democrats better get their act together and ask good questions instead of just throwing their arms up in the air. Okay, that's not going to help anyone. Go ahead, Ron.
Yeah, and we'll see what they do. I mean, when it came to Neil Gorsuch, they certainly just kind of threw their arms up in the air. And I think that one of the things that this does for the Democrats is it really kind of strengthens their argument of blue no matter who. Hey, look what happened. Look at the Supreme Court. For all you people that wanted actually change within the party, for all you people that wanted to run as progressives, for all you people that went to Jill Stein, this is your fault. It's not the fault of Barack Obama, who just kind of let his pick go and didn't do anything about it. It's not the fault of the Democratic establishment, who propped up a flawed candidate and arguably the only candidate Donald Trump was capable of beating. It's not the fault of our political lack of any type of hardball whatsoever and just rolling over to the Republicans because a lot of the Democrats just go along with the Republicans anyway, it's your fault. The whole Supreme Court thing just kind of strengthens their blue no matter who argument. Meanwhile, you know, we're facing a potential hyper-partisan, hyper-conservative Supreme Court for years and years to come. And I'll respond to something Gina said. I don't think the problem with the Democratic money is necessarily Hollywood. Now, this is coming from somebody who the president of show business still will not take my phone call. So maybe there's a little bit. but I think it's, you know, they're bought and sold by the same people. You know, their donors are the pharmaceutical industries. Their donors are big oil. So, of course, they're not going to come out against fracking because big oil gives them a lot of money. Of course, they're not going to come out. Wall Street. Thank you. Yeah. So it's like when you have two parties that are just kind of bought and sold by the same people. One party is allowed to represent those people unapologetically because, hey, we're on the right. This is what we do. The other party is just a little more subtle about it.
Okay, Gina, you know, I really like De Niro's films. He's a great actor. I think he made a complete fool out of himself by making a spectacle out of himself in one of these award gatherings here. I mean, it's really time for Hollywood to kind of simmer down and, you know, we give you a few, well, actually a lot of bucks to watch your films, but I don't need to hear your political opinions, to be honest, okay? Because I don't see anyone really in Hollywood, except for maybe Clint Eastwood, okay, I'll show my prejudice, but I don't see that they're particularly well-informed, and I don't know why they should try to get involved in the political process. Go ahead.
Yes, for example, when they're saying, you know, destroy ICE, it's only existed for 15 years. That's not true. It was just called a different name before. So when Hollywood comes out on these some of these issues, they sort of they make some mistakes because they don't have the historic knowledge that you're talking about. And that doesn't look good either. But I think that Ron illustrates a really keen point here that should be punctuated. And that is when both parties were both listening to the same tune, right? The Wall Street, the, you know, whoever came up, whoever had the big money because they needed it to be reelected. That right there is what I think that people like me who like civility, who like, you know, I am a conservative bona fide, as best I can tell. Again, I keep an open mind, but I think I am. But that's what I liked about a Donald Trump. And that's why I elected and worked hard to elect a Donald Trump. It wasn't because he was like me. It was because he didn't need or seem to want or even seem to have a lot of regard for those same groups that had always controlled, you know, in particular, Big Pharma, in particular, Wall Street, some of those groups. He didn't have a need for them. He didn't seem to care or give them much regard or even respect. And I wanted somebody who would answer to me. And I think that the average Democrat out there right now, they want the same thing. They want a politician who's not bought and sold, who will answer to them. And they can't find that in the Democrat Party right
okay.
now. And that's the conflict.
Okay, I'm going to jump in here. I think the political established left needs to calm down. And I would give the same advice to the president of the United States. That's all the time we have. Many thanks to my guests in New York, Los Angeles, and West Palm Beach. And thanks to our viewers for watching us here at RT. See you next time. And remember, Crosstalk rules.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR, CommunityPublicRadio.org. I'm your host, Don DeBar.